Church Life Today podcast is a production of Redeemer Radio and the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame, and is brought to you in part by Notre Dame FCU and our listeners.
Welcome to Church Life Today, a production of the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame. I'm your host, Leonard DiLorenzo. Especially with the Synod of Bishops focusing on young people, the faith, and vocational discernment, there is an increased focus on what's going on in the lives of young people today, personally and culturally. If the church is asking about vocational discernment for our young people, we're really thinking about their freedom to hear and respond to God's call, to take on the responsibility and joy of discipleship. Our show today is dedicated to trying to get a better sense of what's actually marking the lives of young people. What's their situation? What are their burdens? What are their possibilities? To help us think more deeply, we're talking with someone who's examined the millennial generation from a very broad cultural perspective. Malcolm Harris is a freelance writer and editor at The New Inquiry. His work has appeared in The New Republic, Book Forum, The Village Voice, N+1, and The New York Times Magazine. He hails from Philadelphia. In his recently published book, Kids These Days, Human Capital, and the Making of Millennials, Harris examines broad trends like runaway student debt, the rise of the intern, mass incarceration, social media, and more. He's here today to talk to us about his new book and what he's seeing in the millennial generation. Malcolm, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure. Now, we hear a lot about millennials. They're talked about a lot, but I sort of get the feeling that we don't always know what or whom we're talking about when we talk about millennials. So in all your digging around and your research for this book, did you actually figure out what in the world a millennial is?
Well, that was sort of my goal. Starting out the project, demographers are working with strict date ranges because that's how they're producing data. Mm-hmm. So they'll go from, 82 to 96 or, 78 to 2000 or whatever. I use 1980 to 2000 because I like round numbers.
Yeah.
That's like literally the only reason. Because I don't think that the strict date ranges are what's really important. It's mm-hmm. about your relation to the changes that have happened in America over the past 30 to 40 years.
Okay.
And the millennial cohort, I suggest, has a particular relationship to those changes, particularly changes within the labor market and within work in our country.
Very good. So we're talking, at least the folks that you were thinking about, somewhere in their mid closing in on their late 30s to about 20, approaching 20. So they're young adults in general.
Yeah, and I still haven't seen a compelling break on the younger end. So mm-hmm. I use 2000 as the far end, but a lot of people talk about Gen Z or the post-millennial generation mm-hmm. is. I don't think we've got good cause to talk about that yet.
Okay.
So I'm not sure exactly where the end of the millennials are. I think that's going to be something we understand only in retrospect.
Okay. Now, it seems to me, and I think you touch on this, there's quite a lot of stereotypes about millennials,
definitely.
Right? And so I imagine a lot of what you had to do was kind of wade through these stereotypes and see what's real and what's kind of fabricated. So what did you see? Could you give us an example of some of the most prevalent stereotypes about millennials? And is there truth to these?
Yeah. I mean, the stereotypes I try to almost avoid in the book because mm-hmm. they're just so useless because almost none of them have anything to do with the reality. So this idea mm-hmm. that my favorite one is entitlement, the idea that millennials are really entitled. But then when you actually look at the data, the biggest entitlement we have in this country is Social Security. Mm-hmm. When you poll millennials on Social Security, they support the program, and yet a majority of millennials don't expect to get any money out of it. So if this entitled generation doesn't feel entitled to their literal entitlements, I think maybe we need to refashion that stereotype a little bit.
So just to pause there on the Social Security thing, because I heard you give a lecture here at Notre Dame and you brought this up and it surprised me, right? So you're saying millennials are perfectly okay investing in the system, contributing money, but they don't expect to get anything back. We often think about this is I'll put in money because I think that this is going to serve me later on. But what you're saying is what you find is they're perfectly okay with the system, but there's no expectation there'll be anything there at the end.
Yeah, well, they understand the millennials politically understand the importance of social welfare programs, and they understand the importance of Social Security for older people, which is in Social Security and the increases in Social Security single-handedly responsible for the total decrease of elder poverty in America. Mm-hmm. And now elderly people are the group with the age cohort with the smallest rate of poverty in the United States, which is a positive development in our society. And young people are in favor of that. At the same time, they recognize that the system is not set up with their lives in mind, and that this trust fund has been robbed and the system has been undermined by the people who gained the most from it. It's a tough position to be in.
So along with that, there's perhaps the assumption that these young people are incredibly individualistic, but this as a sort of anecdotal or maybe even more than anecdotal case is showing that there's a great social consciousness and a concern for those who aren't themselves. And in fact, they've got skin in the game.
Absolutely. I think a lot of the biggest thing I found about millennial stereotypes is that so many of them are really baby boomer projections.
So the baby boomers are projecting these stereotypes onto millennials.
Right. So the selfishness or the individualism was like a principal baby boomer value, right?
Okay.
This is the like 60s and 70s, be you, do you, et cetera, et cetera. Millennials don't quite have that same understanding of the world. It requires a certain amount of prosperity to advance that kind of individualism.
Well, let's talk about how we view young people. Maybe this has to do with millennials, and now it's kind of backing up to even those who are more squarely in their childhood now. But it strikes me that a central claim of your book is that, in fact, we treat kids like investments, even if we don't recognize that. Or to put it another way, children are sort of machines of human capital.
Mm-hmm.
What is human capital as you're talking about it, and how is it functioning in the lives of millennials and maybe those who are coming after them?
So human capital are the skills and abilities that we put to work when we go to work. Mm-hmm. So when you're working at any job, you're not just exercising some sort of pure labor capacity. You're also using the training that you have to even, you know, down to language to communicate with your coworkers, but up to, you know, using sophisticated computer systems that maybe you learned on your own time or maybe you were paid to learn at your job, or complicated machinery or social platforms, let's say, any sort of job skills, what we think of as any sort of job skills, which is also how we think of education. Mm-hmm. And this relationship, education in this country, especially under the Obama administration, was totally redirected towards this question of human capital production.
Mm-hmm.
The whole goal of education was super focused on job skills, on education leading to jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so this question of human capital has become really central to the lives of young people in this cohort, because your lives center around producing job skills from the time you're 4 or 5 years old. This is a principal concern, and not just for upper-class children or whatever, but children across the economic spectrum.
And so this would be an investment of time and labor in especially millennials that they would expect to pay them back later on, right? To put in that time through their education, their schooling, their younger years to develop these skills, capacities, abilities with the expectation they'll be in some way rewarded for it later on because you're becoming the sort of person who will be valuable.
Absolutely. In fact, we've been told for years now that human capital is the best investment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can never invest too much in your own education or job skills, and someone will always hire you, and you'll always be able to make more money than you would have before if you don't spend the money on education. That premise is part of what has allowed the cost of education, higher education in particular in this country, to skyrocket so high, because if you think it's always a good investment, then you might as well make more and more and more investment. It's no problem investing hundreds of thousands of dollars if what you've been told is it's always a good investment.
And what are millennials seeing now about that investment they made in their education?
It turns out that you can't just sell human capital. You have to sell your labor. And so to do that, you have to find a capitalist who's willing to hire you to do work, and they set the prices. And the problem with all this human capital production is that as the supply has increased so rapidly, the demand has decreased. If Google gets everyone to train themselves to be coders, they have to pay coders less.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to pay them more, certainly.
Okay. You're listening to Church Life Today on Redeemer Radio. We are talking with Malcolm Harris, author of Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. So is it appropriate to think of childhood as what kids are doing in their childhood as work in their education? As I was following the argument of your book, it seemed that you're saying what they're working on, children in their schooling and in all these skills and abilities that they're acquiring, what they're working on is their own ability to work in the future. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And we really, I mean, if you look at what kids are doing with their time, if you, you know, take an average teenager or even an average 12-year-old or whatever, an average 10-year-old, and you track how they're spending their time throughout the day, if you look at, you know, 5 minutes go by, how are they spending those minutes? You see that these kids are workers, that they're spending their time working on something. The problem is we can't see what the product is of that work. But as it's become more and more important to the national, the global economy, as job skills and human capital become a central part of our production process, we see this children's work becoming more important, and they're doing more and more of it. And we see the elimination of like arts classes, even history classes, for the focus on what seem to be in-demand job skills in science and technology and computers and et cetera.
And that's not just happening within the four walls of a school classroom. It's their engagement in digital media. It's their work in video games, you could even say. Like, it's developing these sort of abilities and skills that actually will later on have a place, perhaps, or are valued, perhaps, in the workplace.
Absolutely. One of the stories that I talk about in the book is a writer and father who tries to do his high school daughter's homework for, I think, like a week.
The guy broke down,
and he broke down. He just can't do it. And when he goes and asks the teachers, like, why are you doing this? Like, what is going, can't you do less? And they say, basically, it's not up to me, or it's important to develop time management skills.
Mm.
And I love that idea that they're overloading children with so much work precisely so that they know how to be overloaded with so much work and to develop the skills of being overloaded with tasks. And that it doesn't even matter what the tasks are. The point is just to overload them with stuff so that they know how to be workers.
So here's maybe this is a loaded question. Do they have a sense, are they actually enjoying a sense of freedom, or is it being masked?
They're legally required to sit in desks learning job skills for the plurality of their day. I don't think any kids would tell you they're free or that they feel free. And I think if you go back in time and survey American kids, maybe they'd feel a little differently.
Yeah.
But I think that probably accurately reflects their experience. Kids today have less freedom, definitely.
They have a feeling of being controlled, having their time and their attention perhaps controlled a lot of time. And one of the things that you were drawing out in the book, especially as this moves into college, and as you're saying, the ballooning cost of a college education is the increasing reality, let's just call it an increasing reality, the prevalence, the depth of debt that especially millennials perhaps now are burdened by more debt than anyone before them, and that doesn't seem like it's going away anymore. In what, or in, anytime soon, in what way is debt an extension of that kind of control from childhood?
Oh, that's a great question. One of the things that they've successfully accomplished through the educational debt system, increasing necessity of family support, and it's kind of interesting because we think of neoliberalism as something that cuts out the family and eliminates all sorts of other bonds. But actually, one of the effects of this withdrawal of public support has been increasing dependence of individual workers or young people on their family resources. Mm-hmm. So we return sort of to a caste system where what kind of life chances you have are directly determined by your parents, right? By what family mm-hmm. you're born into. And so the difference between young people who graduate with tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in educational debt and students who graduate with no debt is huge. Mm-hmm. It's huge. That's a, like, in terms of life outcomes, the biggest difference maybe. And so this educational debt system has really cut down on what we think of as young people's freedom or independence, their ability to make lives for themselves by extending these lines of dependence throughout the family, such that because it takes a whole family to produce, you know, one educated worker.
Right. So there's, in that sense, what you're saying about debt, it seems, is there's collateral damage here, right? So if the child, as they're becoming a young adult and graduate, is absorbing this debt as they go along, and there's considerable investment along the way, financial and otherwise, that debt, that cost is not being isolated to that individual, even though we might think that. It's actually drawing in the resources of those around them. And so it's kind of a drain on this little social unit, principally the family.
Yeah. And it isolates families from each other. Mm-hmm. And it instead of creating bonds of social solidarity, moves backwards into more parochial bonds. Yeah, which it's I don't think is a good thing in the way that it's impacted young people.
So another way I suppose we could talk about this, and I think you do, is in terms of competition. As you were just saying, like the isolation of families from one another, we can perhaps often think about especially high achieving, but maybe not even high achieving, mm-hmm. young people in competition with one another, because even though they may want their friends and their peers to do well, at the end of the day, there are only so many spots in whatever the next stage is, the coveted college, the jobs at Google, like you mentioned. But in the isolation of families from one another, you're saying, because actually that competition gets spread out, that becomes, it seems, the rule. So I want to quote you to you. How about
Excellent.
That? You love, yeah, everybody loves that when you quote you back to yourself. You said, and I think this is in your introduction, the whole school culture is built around hyper competition, from first period to extracurricular activities to homework to the video games kids play when they have a minute of downtime. So here's my question. What has a culture of hyper competition done to your generation, to millennials? And maybe if you want to go from there, what do you think it's going to do to the generation coming after?
Yeah, well, and that's one of the reasons I think it's hard to draw lines between these generations, because we seem to be following these same dynamics, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like we've learned from the millennial cohort and are now doing something different. What we see is just the acceleration of this hyper-competitive situation. And you can see how that affects young people both on an aggregate level, where mm-hmm. the level of competition for the development of human capital drives wages down. We can see that because it increases the supply. Companies don't have to pay as much. This dynamic's actually pretty simple at an aggregate level in terms of the supply of human capital. Mm. On an individual level, we can also see what kind of damage to the psyche that does of constantly worrying about competing with everyone around you. Levels of anxiety are up hugely. Levels of depression are up hugely. Levels of social trust are down significantly. Competition is not good for people. Not at this level.
With no break, it seems, right?
Right. Like, well, and with no real reward.
Hmm. You're listening to Church Life Today on Redeemer Radio. We're talking with Malcolm Harris, author of Kids These Days, Human Capital and the Making of Millennials. So as one serious marker there, we're talking about competition. And another marker that we were talking about just previously, it's control. But you just also mentioned the term acceleration. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's another marker of what we're talking about, that the acceleration of acceleration, I think, as you put it in the book, the growth of growth, that mm-hmm. perhaps one of the constant rules, and it's sort of hidden, but it's always there, is that there just has to be more, 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 more.
Absolutely. And this sort of goes contrary to our idea of what was supposed to happen in the 21st century, where we're supposed to sort of level off and get to the point where we're going to make things better until they can't really get that much better. And then we just keep doing that forever. It was supposed to be the agenda for the 21st century.
Uh-huh.
And that was like supposed to be what our lives looked like.
Economic theorists especially.
Right, absolutely.
Story, right? Yeah.
And instead, we have all these graphs that look like hockey sticks, where like student debt in particularly just starts going nuts around a couple decades ago. instead of this leveling off, we have these this huge patterns of acceleration. And when we see those, we have to worry about what in our society is leading to these unsustainable patterns. And how do we fix them? How do we address these glitches? Mm. But instead, this seems to be the foundation for our society instead of some glitch on top of it. And yeah, it's very worrisome. I think we're leading towards a serious social catastrophe.
Mm. This foundation is not sustainable, in other words.
No, and intentionally so. They don't care. I think the people who are running this country don't care about its sustainability or the world's sustainability. I think they're ready to cash out.
It's sort of an absorption in the present moment, and what can I draw? How can I withdraw my investment at a particular time?
Yeah, enjoy as much as they can personally. Mm-hmm. And we have people who are living with the kind of wealth we've never seen, imagined since mm-hmm. the days of monarchy.
Mm-hmm. And young people are feeling that yawning chasm between those who have and those who don't, those who are scratching and clawing to try to get.
I think so. Jeff Bezos, they just announced Amazon is raising its company minimum wage to $15 an hour because they were getting so much pressure. And all these articles about Jeff Bezos is the richest man in history. So, mm-hmm. What a bad and exploitative boss he is.
Mm.
And I think that tension maybe worried the executives over there, I hope, a little bit.
Hmm. So you also mentioned what this is doing to the psyche of young people. So I wanted, this is a little bit to quote you, but I thought you made a really sharp observation. You put this so nicely. You said, what we have are jittery kids teetering on the edge between outstanding achievement and spectacular collapse, sort of on that border. And I think many of us more than catch your drift there, but I wonder if you can give us some further insight into that.
Well, I grew up in Palo Alto, California, and it was a strange place to grow up because we achieved at a very high level. It's probably the center of human capital production for the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's more education going on there than anywhere, and skill building and et cetera, et cetera. And they pumped that all into the kids. And Palo Alto, California also has a long history of experiments on children, actually, going back to the Stanford Prison Experiment, the Third Wave Experiment, the term Ingenious Studies. There's been a lot of focus on children as human capital in that part of the world. And one of the consequences is you produce a lot. And so a lot of my classmates went on to do these really high-paying jobs, achieve at very high levels. Jeremy Lin, who might be listening, was a classmate of mine. We used to play basketball together. There's some people who really are on top of the world right now. And we also had a very, very high youth suicide rate.
Mm-hmm.
And those things were very deeply connected. And we understood as kids that those things were deeply connected, that this competition and achievement has costs, has consequences in terms of human lives.
Hmm. Are there common coping mechanisms for millennials that have just been sort of built into how they sustain themselves in a culture like that?
That's a good question. I think there's a certain kind of dark ironic humor that is popular in my cohort because you start with this assumption that the world is a very damaged place and that no one's really at the wheel and this kind of chaotic situation. And at the same time, it doesn't seem like there's an obvious way to enlist yourself to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I think there's a lot of earnest commitment and hope and determination. But maybe that won't emerge in the ways that we expect. I guess we'll see.
Yeah, and it does seem that hope is another thing that marks the millennial generation. And it's, to this point, it might seem ironic, but...
The original figuration of the millennial was as this very, very positive, these kids they work so hard, they're so smart, they really care about the environment, they want to change the world. Thank God we have them, they're going to save the planet.
Yeah.
But then as the crash happened and as the resource competition heats up, suddenly millennials are lazy, they don't want to work, they're bad workers, we shouldn't have to pay them so much, et cetera, et cetera.
I love that. Well, you know, there's a lot I like, about what you've offered in your book. And one of the things that I really like is that you don't fabricate some magical solutions at the end to, you know, diagnose the problem and say, well, here's exactly how we fix it, which is a temptation for folks who write books similar to the one you've written. But rather, what you do at the end is you think through some of the different potential responses to our current situation and see where those responses are likely to go, for better, for worse, just kind of think it through, you know, a couple hundred yards. So here's what I want to ask you in closing, and maybe it's the hardest thing. What do you hope for? So in other words, like, whether it seems likely or not, what would you like to see happen? What kind of change?
I'm definitely an optimist, and maybe the book doesn't read that way to a lot of people, but it's because my optimism doesn't involve imagining that we can return to the way things were or some like past golden age of American achievement especially. So my hope is that our entire system is swept from the earth, and I think it will happen. I think we are in the midst of history, whether we realize it or not or like it or not. And we're going to have to do a lot of imagining for new systems and how we relate to each other, as well as a lot of pretty gruesome struggle to free ourselves from the ones that we're stuck under right now. Mm. So that struggle is going to be hard. It's not going to be pretty. But at the same time, I can only hope for that.
Mm. And it requires, there's no way around claiming responsibility for creating in this sense, for personal investment, for communal investment. In other words, it seems like it can't be done for us.
No, in fact, we're going to have to seize that from the people who are doing it for us, because they're not going to want to part with it simply. Mm. They've got a imagination for the future, and if we don't want to live in their future, we're going to have to fight them for it.
Mm. Mm. That the mountains will need to be made low and the valleys filled in.
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, where can people find you online, follow up, or especially where can they find your book?
Well, they can find my book wherever wherever books are sold, certainly.
Wherever the man is selling
right,
it.
Right, yeah. On Amazon.com, where I hear the minimum wage is $15 an hour now. Or their nice local bookstore, where the minimum wage is probably significantly lower than $15 an hour, unfortunately. Uh-huh. I'm on Twitter at Big Mean Internet.
Big Mean Internet.
Yeah, there's a long story about my prosecution by the New York District Attorney's Office. But other than that, my writing appears throughout the world, wherever they will have me.
Very good. We've been with Malcolm Harris. He's the author of Kids These Days, Human Capital, and the Making of Millennials. Malcolm, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again so much for having me.
Pleasure. Thanks to all of you for joining us today on Church Life Today.